This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. We're revisiting eating disorders this week with Anna Sinsky, a wonderful guest who I met through a previous guest, and I'll talk a little bit about how we met later in the intro. For now, some context on the episode. So we've obviously talked about eating disorders a lot on the show so far. Oftentimes that is a specific condition we're exploring, usually with that guest's first-hand experience. Whereas today we wanted to do that, but also look at a range of conditions and really how eating disorders can affect people generally, reflect on some of the conversations we've had previously, and also what's changing in terms of diagnosis, prevalence, how people have been affected by these during the pandemic, and yeah, so many factors. So it's sort of quite a general conversation, but we talk about a lot of specific conditions as well. And so I've tried to keep the stats broad with this to encompass all of that. So in particular, I was interested to look at what the prevalence estimates are these days. And so according to BEAT, the Eating Disorders charity, they estimate that 1.25 million people in the UK have an eating disorder currently. And interesting contrast, the Priory Group estimate that between 1.25 and 3.4 million people in the UK are affected by an eating disorder.
That seems more likely, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, this is something that comes up a lot in the research. It is difficult. A lot of the studies vary a lot. Some of them don't include as wide a range of conditions in them as others. So it makes it very difficult. And obviously different sort of populations, different areas, different communities, different genders can all have different rates of diagnosis. And, you know, sometimes those rates of diagnosis don't really match the rates of prevalence very well. So it's all very difficult to get that estimate. But even at 1.25 million, it's still a massive number. Even if we look at the lower end of that Priory Group stat, that's still around 1 in 50 adults, that would be. So massive. And then another stat that I found that, interestingly, both of them report exactly the same, is that around 25% of those affected by eating disorders are male. And I wanted to highlight that because that is the highest stat I've ever seen for that. I think 15% is the one I'm used to seeing.
Yeah.
And so hopefully that's a sign of progress in terms of us being better at recognising the conditions across a broader cross-section of the population. Because it's not just gender. There's so many ways in which conditions have been overlooked in the past. Our friend of the pod, Hope Virgo, campaigns for weight limits to be taken out of the requirements for getting support on the NHS for eating disorders, because it's just quite a ridiculous position that we're still in, that often people need to end up getting iller in order to get the free support. And that's, yeah, a terrifying position to be in. And also, you know, how much does that account for different body types as well? BMI is not a perfect metric. So yeah, hopefully that statistic, 25%, is a sign that, you know, more people are being recognised properly with how these symptoms can vary across populations, I hope.
Yeah, I know. It's in, when we, you know, in our field and, you know, having these discussions for us, it's always, I guess it seems ironic maybe for somebody on the outside to think when the stats go up, to us that's good, because that means more people are recognised, because we know that the figures that are out there don't represent what's really going on in the world. So at times, yeah, it can mean that maybe more people are struggling out there, but it also can mean, and quite often does, that maybe some stigma's been lifted a little bit and people are getting the help that they need.
That's true. I hadn't even thought of that. That's how far into this stuff we are, I guess, that yeah. We're like, yes, to some of these increases. You're exactly right. But, you know, we hope that that's, yeah, a reflection of more people's experiences being recognised. And that's, you know, very much a conversation at the moment across so many mental illnesses, how the symptoms vary for different people and how we can make sure that there is inclusion in the diagnostics model. And that, again, as an outsider, might seem a bit strange of like, oh, we want to include more people in this diagnosis. That you might be like, what you want to diagnose more people? It's like, no, we want to diagnose more accurately. And sometimes that means diagnosing people that might have been missed before.
Yeah.
Good point. Thank you for that one. And along this same kind of line, actually, about different experiences being recognized, two of the conditions we talk about today are ones that are still in earlier stages, I would say, of being recognized. So muscle dysphoria is one of them. And that is often referred to as well as bigorexia or even reverse anorexia sometimes because of the similarities and differences there. And muscle dysphoria is where somebody has a specific type of body dysmorphia where they see themselves as thinner and less muscular than they are in reality. And so this can lead to extreme behaviors in terms of over-exercising, you know, really having quite compulsive behaviors towards time at the gym and weightlifting, and can also include then extreme like diet modifications in order to, you know, maximize this muscle because the person is not recognizing that actually in the majority of cases they either already have quite a normal body type or they have a very muscular body type already. But the way this specific body dysmorphia works, they don't recognize that. And so they're constantly pushing further and further, and that can mean steroids and it can mean all kinds of dangerous behaviors. So that's something that for a long time just went incredibly underrecognized because on the outside, it can seem healthy. And therefore the assumption is they are, and their behaviors to get to this appearance are healthy. And their perception of themselves is probably consistent with reality. And we can't assume those things necessarily. And also, I think there's definitely elements of when people think about eating disorders, there are often stereotypes that come in and people think primarily about restricting food, even though that is not the only thing that happens in the world of eating disorders.
Absolutely. And I think it's been going on for years and years and years. But as you said, not necessarily recognized because we saw it as something that people were emulating, especially if you're in the fitness industry or in sport and things. We've had the Olympics on in my house like constantly, and we're finishing the Paralympics now, but we've had both of them on for the whole time, and I'm constantly catching myself because I'm constantly saying, oh my God, look at her body, look at her body, look at her body, because I just have so much respect for the athletes and how hard that they must work that allows them to get these times, jump these heights, swim these distances. As a sports person with two young daughters in the house, I'm catching myself and stopping myself and making this be like this amazing thing. I'm in control of knowing what I mean by that and knowing, you know, the ins and outs of stuff, I guess, but they're 10 and 7. So they're not necessarily. So I try and always make sure I, you know, add something to the end of it, you know, that's not, doesn't just see it like it's such like it's a vain, like a vanity thing. Like, oh, she's just amazing. Like I'm really putting her in all, you know, respecting her because she just looks amazing and that there's more to it than that. So even for somebody like me who works within this world and who is also in sport and in the fitness industry, I have to really check myself to make sure I'm aware of maybe any messages that I'm giving out that could be taken differently or could leave thoughts in their minds about what I perceive a great body to look like. I mean, don't get me wrong, when we see bodies of all shapes and sizes, I'm exactly the same. Like, wow, that girl's looking good or the guy's looking amazing. Like, this isn't just, you know, to women like that. And we have had the Olympics on, so... But yeah, I am quite aware of that myself and it's been around for years. And I think the social media, again, ironically, has helped us kind of spot maybe those people who might need some support.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And I certainly hope so. It is often a very clear example of when somebody's perception doesn't match what other people would see. You know, and yet there's still this kind of trap, right, that we want to feel like we know what an eating disorder looks like And there is no template. There is no one way that you look like you have an eating disorder. And so just because a lot of these behaviours are ones that take place externally and, you know, weight may change in this, you know, condition, amount of muscle may change, you know, behaviours around the gym may change. It doesn't mean, you know, as lay people, we can diagnose, but absolutely, you know, potentially we can see the signs. And I think it makes sense to all get a bit better at recognising the signs of a whole range of conditions. And it's just a very much a reflection of how complicated these conditions are. And you hear that very much from our guest today, who's gone through multiple diagnoses and is also a psychotherapist as well. So gives a mixture of her professional perspective, a lot of insights into how people have been coping around these conditions during the pandemic, certain factors that have come up there. And we also just kind of chat generally about like body image and social media pressures and yeah, loads. I don't know if I'm like overblowing it. I'm like, I promise we talk about loads of this interview, just so many things. And I think it helps that this is someone that I know through previous guest Fiske, who you'll know if you've been listening right from the very beginning of the podcast. And he's the founder of Mind Over Matter, which are these wonderful evenings where people come together and there's an open mic element. And so people can contribute poems and music and spoken word pieces themed around mental health. And so Anna is involved in that. She's essentially like the go-to mental health professional that gives that perspective in a way that Fiske comes from a more music background and, you know, coaches people on like sharing their stories. And she's there as someone that can be a professional perspective on the mental health conversations that I had, and is also a poet herself, so also performs. And I have had the joy of seeing her perform and also meeting her at one of the events not long before the pandemic. I met her, I think, a few weeks before we did our live show in February 2020, when we did not know what was coming for us, and we were there enjoying what Fiske does and being like, okay, we want to do our own kind of events and get them to be regular. And then did not know how the world was all going to change so soon.
And the world changed. Was that in Birmingham then or London?
London.
Wow. Yeah, I really want to go to one of the events. I heard they're brilliant.
For sure. So it was so lovely catching up with her and getting to have this wonderful, like I've said, broad chat about eating disorders, you know, and look into, I think, a little bit what, you know, the future of some of these diagnoses and the conversations around them could hold. So, yeah, with that all said, please enjoy this conversation with Anna Sinsky in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
My name is Anna, and my earliest experience related to mental health, I'd say, is something that I actually often think about. I remember around the age of 4 or 5, getting this kind of very specific kind of feeling of dread. I don't really know how to explain it. And I remember it wasn't related to anything being wrong or anything specific happening. It was almost like a feeling in my body, just like something really bad is going to happen. And then obviously, you know, I mean, maybe not obviously, but nothing bad was happening, but it was just such a strong feeling of dread. And when I really think about it, I think sometimes I get this thought that maybe it's related to intergenerational trauma, because there's a lot of trauma in my family that people didn't talk about. And as children, we really pick up on unspoken things and unspoken feelings. So with my perspective now, I sometimes think, wow, that was probably just, you know, a lot of unspoken stuff from my parents or grandparents that I was around all the time. But I remember it very, very clearly, just a feeling of dread, which I think later kind of got transformed to anxiety and later got transformed to eating disorders, different things. But I really remember that route around the age of 4 or 5. Just, yeah, very dreadful feeling and not being able to sleep and just feeling this sense of something bad is going to happen.
Interesting. And we recently did an episode where I kind of went back through some of my early experiences and shared more than perhaps I had previously. And I think similarly, I was picking up on things that I can now understand later, but at the time I couldn't articulate. And for you, it sounds like that there can be such a clear link when you can perceive as a young person what conversations aren't being had, what people are tiptoeing around, and in particular, perhaps the anxiety of other people we can sense from really young. So there may have been things that your parents were worrying about, and then you picked up on the worry and thought, okay, I need to watch out too.
Yeah, definitely. One of my favorite therapists, Gabor Mate, he often talks about how children are like the mirrors of parents. So very often when they're like acting out, especially at very young ages, like 3, 4, 5, 6, it's like they are just absorbing things from you that you might not be aware of. So whatever they're kind of expressing often actually comes from the parents' feelings. They are often expressing the parents' feelings, not their own feelings, because they don't have such strong differentiation yet. So it's really interesting sometimes for me to think about that feeling, knowing this perspective now. Because obviously you don't know that as a child, and then you grow up kind of maybe thinking, there's something wrong with me. Why is no one else feeling this dread? What is this, you know, weird feeling?
Yeah, and that's fascinating, because they may well be in that dread, and indeed that's why you are, and yet we're going around with this mask behavior, and it can take a long time to figure it out in hindsight.
Yeah.
And so when did it start to become a little bit more clear that this was becoming anxiety?
I mean, I don't think it was so clear cut. I don't think it was so clear. The way I think about it now as an adult and as a therapist, I think I was always a very sensitive child. And I think I was always very emotional and very sensitive and like picking up on a lot of things and kind of being, you know, hyper aware of other people's maybe emotions or things. And I think this anxiety often was kind of like the tip of the iceberg. And underneath that was, you know, my stuff and other things from other people. But I don't think it was so clear cut. I think probably when I went to school, it probably started manifesting itself more, or like around, you know, maybe early teenage years, I'd say that transformed to more like disordered eating behavior. But yeah, I don't think these things are so clear cut very often.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I think I definitely had that firsthand experience when going into long-term therapy myself, of perhaps thinking at the beginning, okay, I just need to collect some answers and then it'll all just fall into place. And in fact, you realize you have to go through, I think, a whole load of additional complication of the things you maybe weren't looking at or were avoiding. And then you kind of have to go through that and back up the other side. And then you're like, okay, now I can at least approximate a way to describe what I've been through.
Exactly. No, I think it's really, yeah, very often, also, for example, with eating disorders, I guess I remember at the time when it was like early teenage years and I had this kind of behavior starting within myself, I never thought at that time this has anything to do with anything other than food or anything other than body image, right? So I would just be like, okay, like I really want to lose weight or I really want to look a certain way. So I think very often you get this kind of like laser focus that this is what this is about. But when you go to therapy, you realize this is, again, tip of the iceberg, has nothing to do with your body image very often. It's, you know, things underneath and feelings and unprocessed stuff and traumas and all of that kind of stuff.
And yeah, I think there can be, once you do put in the work and you spend enough time with picking these things apart, there can be a kind of power in the progress where you're like, okay, well, this is less overwhelming to explore, and I notice more of my triggers and I understand more of my past. And I think for me, certainly, that's become enough to be like, I like to feel that I'm getting to understand myself better, as opposed to, I guess, naively, I went in and thought, there's going to be like, I don't know what I visualized, like, am I going to be able to write a list reasons why I'm who I am? It's like, it's never going to be that simple.
No, of course. Like someone's going to give you a manual, like a healing manual. And you're just going to be like, okay, perfect. I am never, you know, now I am a robot and nothing happens to me. And I just process everything like this. Sadly not. There's no fixing.
Yeah. And so for you then, what were those very early symptoms that you noticed with disordered eating?
For me, let me think. I think an obsession, definitely, like obsession with body image, obsessive thoughts with body image, obsessive thoughts with calories. I started counting calories, weighing myself obsessively, just a kind of preoccupation, almost like this is the most important thing in your life at the time. So yeah, it would just overshadow everything. Yeah, counting calories, you know, obsessively thinking about weight, obsessively thinking about food. How is this going to affect my weight? How is that going to affect my weight? So I think these kinds of obsessive thoughts were really probably the main symptom or like the main concerning thing. And I guess lack of awareness that this was in any way disordered eating would also be one of the symptoms. I mean, I was very, very young, so makes sense. But yeah, also later on, I kind of got into a cycle of binging and purging. So these were kind of more clear-cut symptoms because I would really want to have a certain body image, so really restrict myself. But I wasn't really able to restrict myself because it was impossible to starve myself for that long. So then I would go on a massive binge. But then I would feel guilty for the binge. So then I would go back to the restricting. And then you get stuck in this cycle where you really want a certain body image, so you punish yourself so hard that it makes you binge because you just can't live like that.
Yeah. And then you just become so trapped in these behaviors that they become so much of who you are. Like, I think that's such a big trap, sure, that you get stuck in what may have started as some kind of way to cope, feel that you had some kind of power over things that you might dislike about yourself or a part of your life that's particularly difficult. For me, that was certainly when people talk about how much eating disorders can relate to control. That's always been something that resonates quite strongly with me as someone that was really seeking that. And so as certain things got more difficult, those behaviors ramped up. And then before I knew it, those behaviors were probably the bigger problem than what I was trying to cope with in the first place.
Of course, it's almost like you have a root, or, you know, the way that it starts, but then you get so trapped in the behaviors that then the behaviors become the super problematic obsessive cycle. Yeah, for eating disorders, it's normally a combination of things. I think for me, it was mostly kind of just a feeling that I'm wrong. Like, if I really look at the root, that I am bad, I am a bad person, I am somehow wrong and bad and defective. And I don't want to be wrong, bad, and defective. So how do I do that? And then kind of focusing on obviously things that have nothing to do with the actual feeling or resolving that feeling within you or that shame within you. So thinking, okay, these people in magazines look amazing. They don't seem like they feel like they're bad people, or they don't seem defective. Society likes people that look this way. Let me try and look that way. So maybe then I won't feel bad.
And so what was the escalation of these behaviors like?
Let me think. Well, actually, yeah, it was quite a big progression, quite a big story. I think at first it was just more like, oh, slightly disordered eating, maybe obsessing over calories a bit, stuff like that. Then it developed into bulimia, which was very much like throwing up and then again binging, or starving myself for days and binging. So a very kind of typical bulimic cycle. Then I got to a point where I was like, oh, I have to be more disciplined with myself. And that turned into anorexia, which was probably the most dangerous phase of all of that. Yeah, that was very bad. I lost a lot of weight. I was very, very thin. And that was the only time, because with bulimia, you can kind of hide it from a lot of people, which makes it very secretive. But the time when I became very, very thin and I was eating very little, I was scared to go to restaurants because I was scared I would go back to the binging, which would stop me from getting this progress that I was so obsessed with. So, you know, scared to go to restaurants, of course, that's going to affect your social life. And that was really when people started telling me, I started hearing this message a lot. Maybe there's something, you know, maybe there's something off with your eating, or you're very thin now, or, you know, does this worry from other people? Which I remember at the time I would mostly dismiss because I really didn't want to admit that anything was wrong. And this was a very long phase for me that I would try to hide these behaviors as much as possible. I would be very secretive and try to, you know, say, I just have very fast metabolism, or, you know, stuff like that, or wear very loose clothes, or, you know, in a way, not really try to make it that obvious what was going on. But I remember specifically there was a time where I realized, okay, this is really not okay. I went for a trip for a month because it was like a journalism course I was doing. I went for a trip. And I remember during this trip in my hotel where I was staying, there was no scales. And I was so terrified. I was terrified. How am I not going to weigh myself for a month? Like, that's impossible. And I remember I went and I asked some girls from this course if they have some scales. And they were all like, what? Of course we don't have any. Like, why would we have any? And I was just terrified that I'm not going to be able to weigh myself. And the whole trip, I was obsessing over this so much. And I was so sure I gained loads of weight. And when I got home, I felt, okay, I definitely gained like 10 kilos on this trip. And I weighed myself. And I remember I saw in that moment, I lost like maybe 4 kilos. And that was the moment, that was the one moment where I truly realized something is off with my perception. Something is really off with the way I see myself. And that prompted me to get some help. And that also prompted me to change my lifestyle a lot. For a while, that was really actually quite a healthy phase that I got in. I got some therapy and then I also started going to the gym. And I think just being able to focus on what my body can do rather than what it looks like was actually very, very helpful for me in that phase. It was very difficult to gain weight, but there was a part of me that became kind of very interested or very passionate about the gym. And that was very healthy combined with therapy. Of course, that was a very good change. But then over time, that also became an obsession in itself, the gym, which is where I got into orthorexia for a while. And then I reached a peak kind of breaking point with that experience as well, where I was like, okay, I literally am like canceling social plans to go to the gym.
And so if people are unfamiliar with orthorexia?
Yeah, orthorexia is basically like an obsession with health and fitness and just being like really pure and yeah, being very, very obsessive about health and fitness.
So when we think of like people that are into healthy eating, it's like a whole other unrecognizable level to that, right? Where it's, you know, It may not be restricting the amount you eat if we think of like a condition like anorexia, but more so somebody might have whole chunks of the food pyramid where they don't even go near. You know, they may be restricting themselves to very limited food types in a way that actually commonly is not, in fact, healthy, but to them feels healthy because, again, there's that distorted perception that can be common with a few conditions.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Or like even exercising every day, right? It is not actually good for you to exercise that very intensely every day. You know, if you're doing like a walk or a short run, you know, that's very different. But just exercising really intensively every day, eating extremely, and most importantly, getting extreme anxiety when you don't. That's the main thing that really defines orthorexia. So, you know, getting this extreme fear and extreme anxiety as if something again, this dread. Something terrible is going to happen if you don't go to the gym. Or if you eat this one thing that is not in line with your diet, that's it. You will be really unhealthy and you'll get some horrible disease. So it becomes this kind of really, again, in a way, obsession, in a way, very anxiety-inducing to do anything different than your very strict routine. Versus if you have a generally healthy lifestyle, you're able to sometimes have a burger and be like, okay, you know, this is not part of my lifestyle, but I'll just have it every once in a while. You're not going to have this intense anxiety afterwards or before. Or let's say you have a family event, you can't go to the gym. There's no way to go, even though you always go on Mondays, let's say. So you say, okay, well, I have this other thing. That's fine. I'm just not going to go this Monday. So there's a very different mindset behind orthorexia and healthy lifestyle.
Yeah. And sorry, you were saying.
Yeah, I was just saying that then it kind of transformed into, at first it was very good getting me out of that very bad anorexic part of my eating disorders. It was very, very good to go to the gym and kind of become more interested in health, actual health. But then it became very obsessive in itself. And that became, I definitely had orthorexia at the time for a while. And then I had another breaking point with that. I remember I canceled some social plans to go to the gym and then I really regretted it. And then I thought, okay, my life like can't revolve around food and gym and, you know, staying fit and healthy and always working towards these physical goals. And yeah, that's again where I started looking within more deeply. And I'd say that now I'm in a really good place. I do get disordered eating thoughts, but I don't act on them. So I'd say that's pretty good.
Definitely. No, that's, it's always exciting to hear how far people come, and interesting to hear the experience and also the order in which you had those different conditions, because I think what I commonly hear stereotyped is anorexia turning into bulimia. And I don't know whether that's because sometimes people see it as one can have additional behaviours to the other. If you think of the binging and purging in particular, for some people, they'll take that on in addition to the behaviours within their anorexia, and that may be when they get re-diagnosed. So it's interesting to hear it the other way around. But perhaps a bit like with when orthorexia came about, you'd had these ongoing different levels of realization. And so then perhaps at a point where you weren't able to stop the behavior and you weren't getting maybe all the support you needed, changing the behavior to look different felt like more progress than perhaps it was at times.
Yeah, of course. I think also what you said about bulimia often coming after anorexia, there's actually like a biological physical reason for why that often happens. It's because your body is so starved from anorexia very often that you develop this kind of urge to binge. Your body wants you to binge. Your body really wants you to binge. But then obviously you feel guilty about it. So then the purge. So it very often goes in that cycle because your body actually wants you to eat as much as possible when you're anorexic. So it's trying to get you to obsess over food even more. It's trying to get you eat as much as possible. It's trying to get you to crave very specific high calorie foods. So that's kind of why that tends to happen very often.
Yeah. And it's like we said about it earlier, these traps that the behaviors can create, because when you are in the extremes of anorexia, of course, it then can be in one way very rational to be obsessing over food because you're so hungry. So of course you would.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Which is why I think you really have to go to the root cause, because otherwise you will then get a new obsession and a new obsession. Because I think what all these things often come down to is the kind of belief that there is something outside of you, like outside of yourself, some kind of external appearance goal, some validation from someone else or some substance or something. There's something outside of you that can fix something within you that really hurts you very badly.
For sure. And I think with what you've mentioned about orthorexia, I can see the trap of that. And we should say, context, that's a term that is used within medical communities, but is not currently diagnosable as its own condition. So it may be something that's used in a description as part of another diagnosis you get. So it might be described that you have traits of this, but it wouldn't be a standalone diagnosis. And I think that's interesting, because I wonder if that may change. I think it probably will do, particularly in the times we're in now. Like you said, growing up, how much access you had to images and media that encouraged a certain body type, and that being really idealized. And I think the addition of social media adds another layer that I can see pushing a lot of people towards extreme versions of healthy. You know, I feel like I even need a different term for it, because of course orthorexia isn't an example of healthy eating, because you are still restricting your intake, even if it's not restricting an amount or it doesn't resemble certain other conditions.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, also, you know, with orthorexia, a lot of people say, okay, it's healthier than binging and purging. It's on random fast food. It's healthier than starving yourself. And I think there is an element of truth to that physically, but very often it's not, because people, first of all, as you said, they often cut out food groups that actually have nothing to do with health, because they read one article and they're like, maybe this is what I have to follow. Maybe this is the thing. Maybe this is the thing I need to cut out. So you end up cutting out this whole thing, and you know, all of your vitamins and minerals from that whole food group are gone, and you often don't replace it, believing that you're doing something, you know, really, really good for your health. So that's one side. And another side is actually, when you have orthorexia, you are very, very stressed. Your level of stress hormones is super high, because you're constantly anxious about not going to the gym, or what if I eat this unhealthy thing? Or I had a crisp here, or I had this artificial thing here, or is this 100% healthy? Let me read the label. And when you're in that mindset of, I have to do this, I'm so stressed, your stress levels go up way high. And when that happens, all of your bodily functions are actually impacted. The stress you get from that ends up being very unhealthy compared to someone that even, you know, twice a week eats some fast food and is not stressed about it. It makes a big difference.
For sure. And of course, that's what we're missing from a lot of this that we might, pun intended, consume online, is we don't always know the source it's coming from. And, you know, it's not the same as getting advice from a nutritionist, a professional in that area. So you may see the latest fad diet and it could seem like a great addition to your life, whether you're experiencing disordered eating or not. It can still be a threat to you if you're combining it with, say, another diet and you're restricting, therefore, between them too many food groups. But
exactly. If
they're in a glossy magazine or they're on Instagram, they don't come with that disclaimer.
Exactly. Of course, because they're trying to sell you something. So, of course, they're trying to push it from the most amazing side. So you have that. And then, as I said, the mindset itself, it just creates so much stress in the body, which is the root cause of so many hormonal issues, of so many autoimmune diseases, a lot of stuff like that. So I think saying that it's healthier compared to other eating disorders is not accurate. I think on the surface, again, tip of the iceberg, often seems like that. And often people that suffer from orthorexia kind of have this identity of, this is my healthy friend, this is my fit friend. And I think that's also hard to shake.
Yeah. And so in terms of working with clients throughout the pandemic, what kind of things have you seen in terms of people's relationship with food maybe changing? There's obviously been a lot of jokes online and stuff about, you know, the quarantine 15 and things that aren't really that helpful. And so have you noticed, in addition to weight change, more obsessive behaviors or people's eating disorders getting worse about this?
Yeah, I think I'd say two things that I noticed are very common post-pandemic and during the pandemic working with clients. One thing is people tend to eat their feelings a lot more. So obviously, first of all, the whole pandemic, the whole lockdown situation, that's going to cause a lot of uncomfortable feelings, loneliness, emptiness, maybe anger, sadness, also feelings from before that maybe you didn't have time to deal with or you never wanted to deal with, but now there's all this time to deal with them. So people are basically eating their feelings, so binging as a way to just not think about things or not think about their feelings, not process their feelings. So this kind of emotional eating is definitely something I have seen a rise in during the pandemic. And then I think another side would be the kind of more orthorexic behavior, because people are getting so paranoid about potentially gaining weight or so paranoid about not being able to go to the gym, not being able to get their steps in or not being able to be exactly as healthy as they were before, that they're turning to a lot of influencers for advice or a lot of kind of fitness coaches that are trying to sell fad diets, as you said, or like diet caterings that are really just very restrictive and getting into a pattern, a very, very obsessive pattern. These two things are probably the main things that I've noticed. You know, another thing to mention is we talked a bit about the role of social media in orthorexia. And I think during the pandemic, people have been using social media a lot more, simply, you know, first of all, to connect as a substitute for other social interactions that we had, but also just because you have more time at home, you have more time alone, you have, you know, work from home, so you can use it more. So you simply end up using it more. And I think because of that, it's had more of an influence on people. So if the trends are be as fit as possible, why aren't you doing enough? Of course, people are going to see that and they're going to think, oh my God, I am not as fit as possible. Here I am sitting at home doing nothing, even though there's a pandemic outside. In that moment, you're thinking, yeah, I'm not doing anything, right? So you get influenced to follow all these fad diets. You get influenced to, you know, start obsessing.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things that fascinates me, is just how powerful these influences can be. That here we are talking about a condition that isn't yet recognized, but I suspect will be in the coming years. And another example of that, which I think for similar reasons taken a while to be diagnosable. It was formerly known as bigorexia, a term made sound similar to anorexia, and is now known as muscle dysphoria, or will be diagnosed as a type of body dysmorphic disorder. And that is one where people have, I guess, a similar obsession in some ways, but primarily on appearance in terms of muscle and how fit can they look in that way. And it's more commonly seen in men, and we can draw a lot of that back to the kind of stereotypes of how a man should, in air quotes, look, and the kind of things we see, like on Men's Health magazine, where men go through usually at least 4 hours of dehydration to really get that image of the veins pulsating in their arms. And, you know, that is sold to us as health. And yet, even for the photo, let alone, you know, is there a need to be that muscly in the first place? Before we even get into that conversation, you know, even just to get the photo, an unhealthy behaviour is being taken to really make that super bulging appearance. And so this was something that I guess similarly went under the radar or got brushed off as, okay, healthy eating or healthy, you know, bulking up in the gym. You know, it's enough of what we're encouraged to do that I think people can think, oh, well, what's the problem? And then it's taken a while for that to be taken seriously. And I think in many ways it's taken enough people to get to the extremes of unhealthiness with it to then warrant, okay, now we really need to make this diagnosable. And that kind of fascinates me when so many mental illnesses, whilst, you know, names may have changed and understanding has evolved, a lot of the ones we commonly talk about, they've been there as long as mental illness has been a thing that's been studied in the way, you know, broadly that it's studied today. And yet the influence of what we consume can still be powerful enough to encourage different kinds of conditions or different variants.
Exactly. That's a really good point. You know, we can see how our environment and what we consume online really affects the trends, let's say, in disordered eating or in mental health issues, really. I think definitely it's a very, very big part of it. And I think you're right. Very often when people, you know, hear of bigorexia or when they meet someone that is obsessed with the gym in that way, very often it's like, great, you love working out. You know, what is the problem? But there are a lot of problems. It becomes the center of your universe. You know, of course, that's going to isolate you from a lot of people. Eventually, that's going to make you kind of very obsessed and isolated within yourself, because this is the thing. And on top of that, make you so stressed.
Exactly, because a big part of that condition is around the distorted perception, thinking that you're so much less muscly than you are. And so not only are you chasing, you know, if you're looking for that magazine body, you're chasing something that is distorted and probably airbrushed and all sorts to make that a perfectionism that is impossible, combined with the fact that you can then, because of this condition, think you're so much further than you actually are.
Exactly. It's kind of what I talked about in my story with the scale, you know, where I thought, okay, I surely gained so much weight on this trip. And then actually I lost so much weight on this trip while thinking the whole time that I'm gaining weight. And I think a lot of that, you know, we see a very similar thing in bigorexia, in orthorexia. It's just this very unrealistic perception of your own body.
Yeah. And in terms of your own journey navigating some of these conditions, what have been the things that have helped you bring back your perception to something that is more objectively real? There could be such a thing of a person's body, or to what extent do you think that's achievable?
To be honest, I think one thing that has been the most helpful for me, because I think I definitely still see my body very unrealistically. I would sometimes, you know, say to a friend, wow, you know, I'm like smaller or bigger than this person. And they'd be like, what are you talking about? So I think the most helpful thing for me is knowing that my perception is inaccurate, and really, really knowing that. About my body, kind of knowing that my perception of my body is inaccurate. Knowing that has really helped me to not follow these thoughts too deeply, to kind of cut them off as soon as they begin. Because if my perception of my body is so inaccurate, you know, following these thoughts will lead me into a more and more inaccurate place. So I think really kind of being grounded and knowing that this isn't right has really helped me to separate myself from these thoughts a little bit and not act on them much. Yeah. And then I'd say a second thing that is very helpful is, again,
I want to pause on that first one, actually, because you said it so articulately, but I'm also wondering, how do you do that? Because I can see that you might be able to hold the logic, but then the emotions and the fear could still run away from you. So is that part of breaking down those fears, part of what you've been doing in therapy?
Well, yeah, for sure. Learning not to be scared of your feelings. Learning that you can feel fear and it doesn't necessarily mean anything. It doesn't necessarily have to mean that something bad is going to happen. And kind of trusting yourself that whatever feeling comes along, you are able to feel it and you are able to express it. So this is where we kind of get into more like, okay, so let's say if I feel a sense of fear or if I start feeling these thoughts, I need to express them, whether that's in therapy or let's say by writing about it, which is like my preferred way, writing about it, creating art about these kinds of things to express these feelings. That's when they really kind of lose their power over you, I'd say.
Yeah, no, I find that really interesting. And fellow writers and poets talk about it as almost like a certain separation, like it almost becomes a little bit more somebody else's story. You know, the more you write about it, the more you edit your writing, and creates a sort of third party perspective that you don't have when the stuff's all rattling around in your head.
But I mean, also, you know, a lot of the stuff I'm talking about, it's like after a lot of inner work and a lot of like reflection and a lot of, you know, studying psychology and then like doing therapy as well. So of course, it's hard to expect to just get there just like that. You know, oh, I have this thought. Okay, well, I'm just not going to believe it. No, it's not really that simple. It goes much deeper into kind of, you know, the root causes of why are you having all these obsessions with these things. So as I said, for me, that was very much with like feeling very defective and trying to fix that. Okay, why are you feeling defective? And kind of going deeper and deeper into that. And learning to be okay with feelings, with uncomfortable feelings. Learning to feel your feelings. Mindfulness definitely helps with that as well. Sit with things. Another thing would be focusing more and more on what your body can do and not what it looks like. So that original thought that got me out of that anorexic stage of my eating disorder, that was a very productive thought. It was a very productive focus. It just turned into something very toxic because, again, I started being obsessed with fitness goals, started being obsessed with, oh, okay, these muscles. So it turned very obsessive. But if you really try to focus on, you know, the miracle of our bodies, let's say, and what they can actually, you know, being able to walk or being able to run or being able to do things, your body can take you around and allow you to do all these wonderful things. And I think shifting your focus towards that would be very, very helpful.
Yeah. No, I think that's really brilliant. And I think in a way, it's such a rebellious thing, you know, quietly rebellious, to get yourself to focus on actually how wonderful your body is, even despite, you know, how our attention is pulled to criticize ourselves and what we look like and what other people look like. And so it's kind of, yeah, it's kind of punky to be like, you know what, I can walk and that's pretty incredible. Like, let's set the bar there.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's like focusing on all these amazing things that your body can do. You don't have to love the way your body looks. Love the way your body functions.
Yeah. And if I were to personify it, it doesn't really care. Do you know what I mean? You'll still be able to do so many things with your body, whether you think it looks adequate or not.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a very wonderful book with a lot of different exercises related to this kind of eating disorders and body dysmorphia, body image stuff. It's called Beyond Beautiful. It's a very, very good book about body neutrality. And I often recommend this to clients as well, because they kind of talk a lot about the history of like how the media wants you to have issues with your body and, you know, how they want you to focus on your appearance, about, you know, where focusing on your appearance excessively, where that came from as an idea. If we look at like wider societal context and just different exercises to shift your focus to what your body can do to other things in your life than your appearance. Really, really great book.
Yeah. And something that I'm seeing a lot more online, which I do like, there are some things on social media I'm very keen on, is there is a bit of a trend at the moment towards people pushing for what's often called body ambivalence. So for many people, it can feel insurmountable, get to a place of, I really love my appearance. And so something that can seem like more of a compromise is actually if I can care less about whether or not I'm beautiful, care less about whether or not I'm ugly, and exist in a more sort of in-between space. And I think for me, personally, I guess my version of that, even before I started seeing this, was focusing more on how I present myself for entertainment, if that makes sense, to myself. Do you know what I mean? Of just like, I want to wear the clothes that I like, that are funky. I don't care about what they make my body look like. You know, and sort of taking that, I think similarly to you, a lot of how I dressed, particularly from kind of late teens up, was very much centered around like baggy clothing and covering my arms and, yeah, never wearing shorts and just being as much like a box that nobody could intuit anything about. And also, I think a lot of that was, I felt very uncomfortable with the idea of being sexualized in any way. So it was also like, I just want to be, you know,
a shape, like an ambiguous, like a shape from maths, you know, like a square or a box, not a person.
Exactly. And I think then as I got help, that sort of intrigued me still. So rather than go like, okay, now I'm okay with this, so now I can like dress more how I'm expected to dress, and I can wear stuff that's tight fitting and that is the correct size for my body. And I was sort of like, but that's, you know, that's quite boring. And that in many ways, I think, felt like I was being set up to fail. And particularly like working in the modeling industry, for me anyway, irrespective of whether or not my agent or other people might think this to be true, it feels a lot more achievable for me to be a quirky, distinctive model than to be like some kind of Ken doll. And actually, I wouldn't want that because I'd just look like some kind of carbon copy, and I'm not convinced that I would be the most attractive of them anyway. And so instead, if I can sort of entertain myself with my appearance and wear what I want and mess around with my hair and dyeing it and cutting it and, you know, wearing nail varnish and going in and out of androgyny with my appearance, that's something that I guess feels more an authentic representation of me, you know. So not even reject, you know, media ideas of beauty, not embrace them, but instead just be like, what do I think would be entertaining to look like?
It's very empowering. That's what it sounds like.
Yeah. That's exactly what I find. And I even, here's something silly for you. I even have a bit of a plan in my mind for like, as I get older, I just like the idea of progressively looking more like Gandalf. And it would be kind of a distraction from the aging process. Do you know what I mean? It's like,
oh my God.
Grey hair is the one thing I'm really excited about of growing old. Young people pay a lot of money to have grey hair and put their hair through all kinds of bleach hell. And so I kind of look forward to that just going out of my head.
Oh my God, I love that. I love that perspective. That's, see, again, shifting your focus, very therapeutic.
Yeah. I don't think we've really talked about that. I don't know if I've shared that on the podcast before.
Revealing secrets on the podcast.
But that's certainly something that's worked for me. And it's also quite fun. If people ever ask me why I like dressed a certain way, I'll be like, because it entertains me. They don't know what to do with that answer. It's very difficult to have backlash for an answer you've never heard before.
I think that's really great. Really, really great. I think, you know, similarly, it can often be, if you focus on a feeling, what feeling do you want to embody for appearance or with your clothes or, you know, makeup or something like that? Again, that really shifts the focus from, okay, am I fat? Am I thin? Am I muscular enough? What feeling do you want to embody today? Really kind of good question to ask yourself.
Yeah. And, you know, if you have incredible, crazy makeup like so many people can do now, and I guess a lot of that is learned from social media, that's what's going to catch somebody's eye anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's the thing you get to lead to with if that's your thing that you choose. So Yeah, I'm interested to see how like the body ambivalent thing develops, but I think that could be an accessible option for a lot of people, like really loving your body, because I don't know if that is for everyone either. Do you know what I mean? I also don't think we can police everybody has to feel a certain way about their body.
I mean, my issue with body positivity or feeling like I must love my body is, again, it adds stress. What if you just say to yourself, no, I don't have to love the way my body looks. I don't even have to care. I don't have to love it. And maybe I never will love the way it looks. You see, that can often be a more empowering, you know, point of view for someone that has spent a lot of time focusing on, it doesn't look good enough, it doesn't look good enough. Telling someone then, all of a sudden, learn to love your body, feels like a very stressful task. It again feels like something they won't be able to achieve.
Yeah. And I guess if I really think about that, I do think I've learned to love my body, but I've done so through the lens of what I think yeah. can be cool about my body, as opposed to, fine, I'll be a Ken doll.
Of course. And, you know, it will work for some people. Some people will find body positive movements a lot more empowering. So it will work for some people. But I think the irony often is when you kind of accept that you're not going to love your body, or you're not going to love the way it looks, when you, through that acceptance, you actually end up eventually loving your body.
No, I can definitely see that. So there's options out there, I guess, is the message. And it's been so lovely chatting all of this through with you. We'll probably mention it in the intro, how I met you. And so the last time I saw you was in London at a Mind Over Matter event, getting to see loads of cool music and spoken word and poetry, including, I'm pretty sure you performed that night.
Yes, I did. And it was actually an eating disorder poem.
And is there anywhere else people should go and find you online, or do you want to give a plug to Mind Over Matter?
Yes, of course. Of course. Yeah, so we have a lot of in-person events again from Mind Over Matter now that restrictions are lifted. But also we have a virtual open mic, like an Instagram Live open mic, every Tuesday, 7 p.m., hosted by me. So yeah, tune into that if you can't make it for the live events.
Brilliant. And I would recommend them so highly. It's been incredible to see how much that's grown and persisted through lockdown.
Of course, yeah. I mean, now we also have workshops. We have workshops, again, facilitated by me. They're like psychotherapeutic writing workshops where we basically like meditate and then we do some free writes together. So that's on Sundays.
Oh, okay. I think I might know what I'm doing on Sunday. Great. Well, thank you so much for sharing, and yeah, great to catch up.
Thank you too. Thanks.
Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.